This is Paul Hurt and Jennifer Sweeney of Arizona State University interviewing Leslie James in Flagstaff on August 21st of 2019. Leslie, thanks so much for interviewing with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
You bet. Let's start out by you telling us the positions that you've held in the Adaptive Management Program, the years that you've been involved, and the interests that you represent.
Okay. I started with the Adaptive Management Work Group as a designated representative, an AMWIG member, in 1999, representing one of the two seats of power customers or entities representing purchasers of power from Glen Canyon Dam. And I've been reappointed to that position periodically, whenever the appointments have come back up since that time.
Mm.
So since 1999.
What were those organizations that
The Colorado River Energy Distributors Association, or CREDA. CREDA is a not-for-profit organization that represents the majority of the firm electric service customers of the Colorado River Storage Project. So our members are all not-for-profit entities. They are all they all have contracts with the Western Area Power Administration and allocations from the Colorado River Storage Project.
Mm-hmm. And was there a second organization that you said that you were also involved in that, besides CREDA?
No, I've okay. been the CREDA executive director since June of 1998.
Mm.
So I came on to AMWIG shortly after the next reappointment time.
And you're still serving in that capacity?
And I'm still serving in that capacity.
Great.
Same job, 21 years.
So you've been involved since 1999. That's a good long time with the Glen Canyon Adaptive Management Program.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the main changes that you've seen in the program over that long period of time? How did it start out, and how did it evolve over time, and your participation in it?
You know, the main changes I've seen, when I first started, the program was primarily managed by the Bureau of Reclamation. At that time, the science was provided through the USGS, Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center, but reclamation was where the program was housed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't recall the year. It was probably early 2000s. Then Assistant Secretary of Water and Science, I can't remember his name, brought the question of where the program should be housed to the AMWIG. And I remember the meeting. We were sitting in a hotel conference room in Phoenix, and the question came up, should the Adaptive Management Work Group stay underneath reclamation, or should it move to USGS, Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center? There was quite a bit of discussion, as I can recall, and someone asked the question, well, where does the funding come from for the program? And the response was, the funding is almost solely from CRSP power revenues. And so, and his name was Mark, I'll think of it. So he called for the question and said, what do people think about leaving it with reclamation or moving it? And the vote came down to leaving it with reclamation. And shortly, you know, I don't recall what month that was exactly, but shortly thereafter and just before he left office, he issued a memo transferring it to USGS GCMRC. So that underscored one of the roles of the Adaptive Management Work Group, and that is not, it is not a decision-making body. It is a body that is intended to make recommendations to the Secretary of the Interior. So that's a prime example. There was another example at 1.2 where there was a vote to do a high-flow experiment. And it was way before the high-flow experimental protocol, and the vote was to not do it, and Interior decided to do it. And that was in a Republican administration. So, you know, partisan politics aside, you know, it just kind of underscores that Yeah, the secretary has an obligation under all of the underpinning laws, the law of the river and everything else, to do certain things with this dam and with this program, and we are an advisory committee.
Have you noticed that there are different periods in which the AMWIG seems to have more influence and the secretary is more deferential to its recommendations versus times in which the secretary is more hands-on directive and AMWIG is more advisory?
I don't know if it's hands-on. Well, I think it's more or less participative. Mm-hmm. Maybe not mm-hmm. so directive, but with the... You know, I'm trying to remember how many different secretaries, designees I've kind of lived through. The first one I recall was Steve Magnuson. We had Mark Limbaugh. We had Brenda Berman. We had Mike. He was a reclamation person, not for very long. And really the biggest difference I think I saw was after the 08 elections, Assistant Secretary Ann Castle became more directly involved. And, you know, you heard some of that today from discussion about guidance memos and the guidance memo that she issued early on in her tenure, setting out her priorities. And that was a guidance memo that the program, Reclamation, USGS all took to heart and said, you know, Ann Castle's guidance is, these are her top priorities, these are her resource priorities. And so I would say during that period there was more direct involvement from D.C. And I don't know that that's a good thing. I don't know that it's a bad thing. I think it's a different thing. To a large degree, though, again, I think that the secretary needs to provide some sideboards and provide some guidance. But if this is really intended to be a federal advisory committee, then let it operate. And let it truly reflect the interests that are outlined in the laws that establish it and the requirements that establish it. Let it kind of do its thing, within reason, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, the original budget, and I think the original vision for the program, was fairly modest. In the studies that were done prior to the first environmental impact statement, the ROD was finished in 1996, the 95 EIS, 1996 ROD, and that was under Secretary Babbitt. But I think there was some anticipation that it was going to be quite a fairly modest program, maybe five or six people. And so you ask about one of the significant changes. One of the changes came about in the 2001 appropriations bill, where there was some language included that established a cap on the amount of power revenues that could be used to fund this program. And, you know, there was quite a bit of consternation from some quarters when that legislation went through. But likewise, the agencies knew that legislation was being proposed. And as I sat in a meeting where the Senate staffers sat us all around and said, this is what we're proposing. I just want to make sure you all see this. So anyway, the funding cap, I think, especially now with some of the challenges that we're seeing with federal budgets, with OMB directives, and with limited funds everywhere, I think that was probably a pretty important thing that happened. Because at that point, it was capped at $7.5 million per year, adjusted for CPI. And it's pretty clear on what the funds can be used for. And it was intended to cover the biological opinion and NHPA cultural resources. So, you know, that was, what, 18, 19 years ago, almost 20 years ago.
And
that was a big change.
And now our cap is about 9?
It's up to about Is it 11.3 million.
And that's just consumer price index inflation each year since
right.
that cap. So that cap is still in place.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
So let's concentrate a little bit more on hydropower and its role in the adaptive management program, because that's the interest that you are sort of responsible for representing. Talk a little bit about, you know, from the early years on forward, how you tried to bring hydropower interest to the table and how you negotiated with other interest groups.
Well, you know, prior to my coming on the AMWIG, the 95 EIS and 96 ROD had been issued. Mm-hmm. The hydropower impact from that ROD was about a one-third reduction in capacity. So it had already happened when I came in. And, you know, that was a pretty robust process. I worked on it peripherally in my prior employment at Salt River Project, because when I was at SRP from 1995 till 1998, I was a CRETA board member for SRP. So that's how I got to know CRETA, was in that capacity. But during those years, that EIS was going on. The thinking of the ROD at the time was it was really primarily heavily driven by sediment resources. Certainly, we had an endangered species, but that was a primary key resource. And so, with hydropower being restricted, our thinking at the time was, well, we have what we have. We have a record of decision. So let's just get in this program and try to make sure that the monitoring is really capturing how the ROD flows are affecting resources. Are they doing what people thought in the analysis? Are they not? And, you know, are there ways to try to gain back some of that lost capacity within the existing constraints? So that really has been, if you look at the CRETA mission and vision, and that is to preserve and enhance the availability and affordability of the resources of the Colorado River Storage Project in an environmentally sound way. That's our mission. Mm-hmm. So I bring that to my role in AMWIG. And, you know, it really is trying to ensure that the science is sound, is appropriate. So since I've been in AMWIG, CRETA has funded biologists. For a while, we funded a geomorphologist, Bob Musseter.
To study sediment flow?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And we had a cultural resources expert. Kurt Dongoski worked for CRETA for 6 years.
Really?
Yes, because we really wanted to be sure that we had the technical capability and advice from the cultural folks as the programmatic agreement and those things were going on. So we as an organization are very small, but we have spent the significant portion of our budget trying to ensure that we have technical support and support to help the program. Mm-hmm. It's not always welcome, but it's there. Uh-huh. It's there. So that's been really my objective, is to hopefully educate people about where does this hydropower go? Why is it marketed the way it's marketed? Who are the customers? And I'm still haven't been quite as successful as I'd like to be with the tribes. Because in the year 2004, the resource was up for a new marketing plan, and we supported all of the CRSP customers taking a 7% reduction in their allocations to create a resource pool for tribes to ensure that all the tribes could have some of this CRSP resource.
An allocation of hydropower.
So in 2004, all of my members' contracts were redone. There was a 7% pool, and 53 tribes now had an allocation of CRSP. Some already did. A couple already did earlier, Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Mm. But in 2004, you know, we were very supportive of that.
Nice.
I think the struggle here is most of the folks, the tribal folks in this forum, are probably not the ones that deal with their power resources and their contracts with their providers and their transmission contracts. So we keep trying to say, as a tribe, you should have the same concerns we have about availability and affordability, because you're the same customers as we are, and the contracts are the same.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, you said that with the Record of Decision in 1996, they had already decided to reduce the amount of hydropower generation capacity at Glen Canyon Dam by about a third.
Right.
Since then, has it been reduced further, in your view, or has it stayed about the same, or has it gone back up?
Good question. No, it's been reduced further. Mm-hmm. With the LTEMP EIS and Record of Decision, the selected alternative further reduced that. Let me put it in dollars and cents. There was a study that looked at what did that one-third translate to. Argonne did that study, and they valued it at about $50 million per year annual impact. That was from the 96 ROD. The LTEMP ROD, EIS and ROD, valuation of reduction or negative impact to hydropower is $104 million. But that's over the 20-year period.
And that's derived from restrictions in how the dam is operated that make it difficult for the dam to optimize its operation to maximize revenue. Is that about right or not?
Not quite. The last two words, and that's an education that I haven't been successful at either, because a lot of times these impacts are characterized as revenue. Mm-hmm. What they really are is less cost expended. So WAPA has long-term 40-year contracts with each of its CRSP customers, including all the tribes. They provided allocations to everyone. If the total integrated projects of the Colorado River Storage Project aren't able to meet those commitments, or meet them in the time it's needed, they can always meet the quantity. It's just when, the timing. But when they don't, WAPA has to go out on the market and purchase replacement power.
I see.
So when the operations get changed and restricted, they have to buy more replacement power.
And that could be more expensive.
It will. Well, you know, we heard a lot today about wind. Mm-hmm. But generally, at the time they're having to buy, it is more expensive. Mm-hmm. So it isn't a revenue maximization. It's trying to avoid cost avoidance. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the
clarification. That's a hard concept because I cringe whenever I hear revenues. Mm-hmm. At least we haven't heard profits so much anymore. But revenue, yeah.
So continuing along the same lines, what other issues related to hydropower and its relationship with the rest of the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program objectives, what other issues have you worked on over the years that you've been involved?
Related to hydropower or others in the program?
In the program.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I participated in, we had tried to have kind of a robust public POAG. Public Outreach Ad Hoc Group, the POAG. And the POAG did really some good work. We produced some white papers talking about each of the resources. Mm-hmm. I think they're still out and around.
What are each of the resources?
All the downstream resources?
Uh-huh.
Okay, let me count the ways. How many objectives are in LTEMP? So we have endangered fish, native fish and other species,
Recreation,
hydropower, cultural resources. You know, if I think back to the desired future conditions, there were four.
Four.
Cultural resources, hydropower, ecosystem. Uh-huh. And what was the other?
Wilderness.
Mm-hmm. No. No. And interestingly, then this is where there's been a debate. Is sediment a resource?
Uh-huh.
That's why I thought you were trying to catch me on that one.
No.
sediment, in my humble opinion, Sediment is a resource, but it is not an objective. An objective should be what is sediment used for or used to benefit. And that's where in the desired future conditions year and a half long process, that group made that determination that sediment was not in and of itself a resource. It's what you do with it.
When did you work on those desired future conditions?
Okay, that was a good process that there is a lot of documentation out there. Mm-hmm. This was Secretary, it was Ann Castle, so Secretary Salazar. Yeah. The question came up, what are the desired future conditions of this program? Where do you want to be when you grow up? Mm-hmm. And so they hired a facilitator, and I don't even ask me his name because I can't remember, but for about a year and a half, I think, we worked in groups to establish a set of desired future conditions for the resources. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very hard process because we had a lot of different interests, but the end result was a report and recommendation that was adopted by Secretary Salazar. And it came up, I can remember the dates, it was about the 2010. The report came up, was recommended to the Secretary, and he adopted it. What Assistant Secretary Castle then said is, okay, we now know what the desired future conditions are. We need to put metrics to those. Mm. How do you know
when you've achieved it?
And that's exactly the question we're facing again today. At that time, though, the thinking was LTEMP, the LTEMP process would establish those metrics. Mm. And it didn't quite get there. Mm. But that the desired future conditions and our with that type of a facilitated process, it was pretty good. And for some of those resources, they started getting into metrics, like how many trout, how many humpback chub, hydropower. We had our metrics kind of down because it's much easier. But some of the other resources, how many and where, what beaches, how many and where, vegetation things. But there's a very, very good report that went up to the Secretary. Larry Stevens and George Kahn, who was with Colorado River Commission, were the chairs of that Desired Future Conditions ad hoc and wrote up the report. So that would be that's a very important document.
We'll go back and take a look at it. We got to interview Larry Stevens and a lot of other people that you've mentioned we've interviewed.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a little bit about this Desired Future Conditions document and the resources. I find this interesting. Sometimes one or more resources are compatible in a vision of a desired future.
Right.
And sometimes some resources have conflicting desired futures. Which resources were hydropower visions of a future able to ally with, and which ones were you more in conflict with?
And that's been very interesting because from work that was done in the 5-year fall steady flow experiments that Bill Pine et al. Worked on, looking at humpback chub. They did a 5-year experiment where they steady flowed the river during the fall months. Mm-hmm. The hypothesis being we should steady the flows to preserve sediment because sediment is important for backwaters, which are important for humpback chub. The findings ultimately of that 5-year study were humpback chub don't select for backwaters. Mm. They prefer other areas. And in fact, if they do use backwaters, they get eaten. So right there was one of the lights went on things, because early on, high flow experiments were primarily justified to benefit endangered species. And after that study, it's like, no, aren't we? No. So the next round of arguments supporting high flow experiments, then we're getting to cultural and aeolian transport, but not so much the endangered species debate. So what went on there, and also in 2005 and 6, there was a little bit of an experiment done to agitate to increase flows to disadvantaged trout. And that's where you're starting to see more about trout flows. So between those two studies, what that basically said is, at least we think, fluctuations are good for humpback, for the endangered species, because they can be used to disadvantage the predators and competitors. So in fact, I think if you looked at the analysis that was done for the LTEMP and for the swing weighting process, has anybody talked to you about the swing weighting process?
No.
Okay, I will in a sec, because that was important. There's documentation on that. Hydropower fluctuations that are good for hydropower can also be good for endangered species, and that's very important to us. Hydropower, and I think here's another light that has gone on over time. Operations for hydropower fluctuations tend to not be good or complementary for sediment, but it's temporary. Because with HFEs coming in, you can redeposit the sediment, park it up there. Fluctuations don't get up that high. Where the science is showing us now is volumes are more impacting on sediment, not fluctuations. So that became apparent when the equalization flows occurred in 2012 or whatever, because of the operating criteria, they had to do equalization. Those were flat and steady. They killed us. They killed hydropower.
A lot of water downstream from the dam to Lake Mead.
Yeah. So when you're looking at sediment impacts, you can't just say hydropower is always butting heads against sediment, because it isn't. It's volumes, and the volumes are not dictated by hydropower needs. The volumes are dictated by compact requirements. So, you know, in an opportunity to look at, when we're starting to look at what are potential experiments, I would like to see, let's do some more fluctuations, and let's be sure and monitor that sediment, and let's see if an 8,000 cap really does the damage, or anything above 8,000 damages what the old 1987 study said it would.
8,000 cubic feet per second.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the cap on...
That's the cap on operations, and that's very detrimental to hydropower, especially in summer months, because you may, and especially in low volume months, because you're just hitting this cap, and your demands are up here, your summer peak demands. So I would, you know, in a perfect world, I would love to see someone dust off Bishop study from 1987 that was cited in LTEMP that in fact used 10,000 CFS as its metric, not 8, and see exactly what it does to the system. The safety was another issue, and just kind of
safety of what?
Of rafters, recreationists.
That fluctuation is difficult on people camping on a beach,
right?
For
but
example.
Is there a difference between 8 and 10? I don't know that. How do you know that till you try it?
Well, that sounds like a perfect example of adaptive management, right?
Absolutely.
You have a hypothesis, you do an experiment, you learn, and then you adapt your
management. That's exactly right. And, you know, we tried very, very hard to get an experiment included in LTEMP that would just do that, and that would challenge what is being cited as the best available science, which is a 1987 study that used 10,000 CFS, not 8. And that's the science that was cited for keeping the 8,000 cap. And because it was a cap in the 96 rod, too.
So it became a regulatory cap because it was part of a record of decision.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you feel like that hydropower interests have been a full and fair voice at the table that you get listened to? I know in some of our interviews with tribal representatives, they express concerns about how their perspectives are not, you know, accepted as readily as others. How do you feel hydropower's role has been at the table?
You know, I don't feel like we're precluded from trying to comment like I have mm-hmm. been on, why don't we do some experiments here or there or whatever. I think, though, that, and I'm glad to see over years, because years ago there was a common theme that the DOI agencies only listened to the states and the power providers. And that was pretty commonly held. And for the life of me, I would always say, why would you think that? Our resources cut by a third. In LTEMP, we are the only resource that is negatively affected by the preferred alternative. If you look at all the objectives in the LTEMP, we are the only ones that aren't benefited. So let me talk for us. So, you know, I think, and it may just be lack of understanding, and I think, like I said, we've really, really tried hard to help educate about we are not Enrons. We are, you know, this resource has to go to the nonprofits and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's been a better understanding of that role, I hope.
Hmm. On the other members of
the other members
and other stakeholders.
Yeah, yeah. There may still be, you know, and even there have been times when even we've had differing views from WAPA. Mm-hmm. We aren't WAPA. We are utilities that provide resources to retail customers. They aren't. WAPA is a wholesaler. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we've tried to distinguish ourselves. We aren't a federal agency, and we aren't WAPA. So we do have kind of a different voice. And it was pretty telling after LTEMP, one of the tribal reps said to me, now you know how we feel.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, again, we've been cut by a third plus more, and we're the only resource through this analysis that take a hit. So let me tell you for a second about swing weighting, because I think that's an important piece, that's an important and an interesting aspect of this program. I think it was maybe in 2012 or 13, hard to know, at the beginning of AMWIG. The department decided that they wanted to do a structured decision-making process, or swing weighting. They brought in a guy from USGS back in Virginia or wherever, and we, all the stakeholders, sat in a room for maybe 2 days. And first we learned, we had scientists all talk to us about the resources and the state of play of the resources, and then they talked to us about potential alternatives, the LTEMP alternatives, in fact. They educated us on all six, I think, maybe five, and what those alternatives were hypothesized to do. Then all of the participants were asked to swing weight. And it was a really hard to understand, complicated kind of process, but it was attempted to elicit stakeholder values on how these LTEMP alternatives would perform and how the stakeholders value all of the resources based on how the LTEMP alternatives would perform. So after learning and listening, we did, filled out all of our forms, and it really was very, very complicated. You had to, I still couldn't replicate it, but it's all documented. And The interesting thing that came back, some of the participants were skittish about it because it was, how is this going to be used in LTEMP? Are you going to make decisions based on that? And, you know, we were assured this is just to inform. We're not making decisions. We're just trying to determine values. So the results came back the next day, and irony of ironies, alternative B, which was the hydropower alternative, scored the highest. Among all the
AMWIC stakeholders, yeah. Expressing. Uh-huh. Interesting.
But you look at, it's hard to interpret the table. I went back and looked at it because I've been trying to clean through my files on some things, but it's a fascinating process to look at the various charts and graphs that they produced. And again, it's another piece of information. So I think structured decision analysis maybe became an appendix or something in LTEMP, mm-hmm. but that report and all that stuff's out there. Mm-hmm. So another interesting, what made me think of that is your question about how the different resources conflict or are compatible. Mm-hmm. Because the traditional conflict at this table is sediment and hydropower. You know, it's just kind of an assumed thing. But I think we're starting to get there where it isn't the fluctuations and following load. It's volumes. And volumes are not dictated by hydropower contracts. They're dictated by law of the river.
Now, some of the earliest complaints about the impacts of Glen Canyon Dam were mm-hmm. from the river rafting communities
right.
about those fluctuations leaving them high and dry in the
right.
morning or having floods come into camp in the evening.
Right.
And that probably continues to be a difficult to reconcile set of values, I would imagine.
It may be if the operations did that, but since modified low fluctuating mm-hmm. flows,
it has not been a problem.
It hasn't been
then.
A problem. So that's why I'm saying it would be very interesting to dig out the 87 study, Bishop, that assessed the views of the recreation, the rafters, and the fishermen, because look what operations were back in those days. Mm-hmm. 1983, you know, the highest releases ever.
Yeah.
All of that was pre-initial EIS and ROD.
Mm-hmm.
So perspectives of how people can manage different flows have to have changed because they haven't seen those kind of flows since 1996.
Mm-hmm. Going back to challenges that you faced and accomplishments, can you name any more? You know, in this 20-year or so period you've been involved, what other challenges did you face in articulating hydropower interests and accomplishments you may have?
I think probably one of the biggest challenges is trying to do a better job of really educating what this federal hydropower resource really is and what it isn't,
mm-hmm.
and who the customers are and who they aren't. And also, you know, I as I indicated, CRETA has been a big part of our limited budget, trying to bring in science expertise. But we aren't the federal scientists, and I think we've kind of learned that's just the reality. You know, the USGS science folks and reclamation science folks and other science folks, they may listen, and, well, thank you for your input, but we aren't federal scientists. So if I had to do it all over again, I'm not sure I would have recommended
spending that much money.
Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of money. The biggest part of my budget has been environmental stuff.
Mm-hmm. To try to position you to be a more informed advocate
right.
for your interests.
Right,
yes.
And you know, to try to understand the other science. Because
mm-hmm.
like
right.
I said, we hired a biologist and a geomorphologist. We didn't hire hydropower expertise.
Right.
Because we thought we had it with the utilities.
Right.
But one of the accomplishments, I would say probably one of the biggest accomplishments, was being able to develop and submit what was a viable alternative in the LTEMP EIS. And it was alternative B, and that was an alternative that we wrote up. We had science behind it. Again, I'm biased, of course, but if alternative B had been selected, every resource in LTEMP would have still benefited.
And did any elements of alternative B get selected in the final preferred alternative?
Well, a concept. The monthly volume concept and the fluctuating flow factor was a concept that we supported from the state's alternative, the RTCD. That was alternative C, I think, or D. The state's alternative was developed by utilizing a lot of science that this program has used. You know, you name it, all the fish guys and the sediment, they drew from them and developed an alternative that would have only had a little negative impact on hydropower, a little. You know, in a perfect world, I would like to have seen that alternative go forward, because the proponents of that alternative went and met with all the stakeholders, tried to incorporate their concerns, met with the fishermen, the tribes, everyone. And I think that was a really good community alternative. But Interior brought in an alternative and then made some compromises on the fluctuating flow factor. And just to give you numbers, so the states proposed 10s and 12s. 10 times the monthly volume for a fluctuating flow factor in the peak months, 12 and then 10. The Interior alternative proposed 7s, flat 7. So the volume and the fluctuations would have been much less.
Mm-hmm.
So the preferred alternative compromised between
those
numbers.
Two.
Yeah. And the CRETA, the B alternative, the only really real difference was we would have had 10s and 12s during the peak and the other months. Otherwise, it wasn't a lot. And one other difference. The alternative B restricted HFEs to no more than one every other year. So that was basically the difference in the alternatives. But that was, I think that was one of our really good accomplishments. I think that it kind of became a bookend. You know, I have to wonder what a preferred alternative would have looked like, but for that experiment or that alternative. But, you know, just being able to articulate the science and write it up and have it be a viable alternative was a good accomplishment for us.
What's the relationship between HFEs and hydropower interests? Are HFEs not a good thing for hydropower, or can hydropower utilize the HFEs effectively?
Unless there's an HFE that hasn't been designed yet, there will never be an HFE that benefits hydropower.
Okay.
Now, there will be different HFEs that you can reduce the negative impact. And so I think that was really the reason we started promoting Project N. And that was, when you're doing any experiments, consider the effects on hydropower, because there could be some win-wins here.
Sure.
An HFE, and that I'm encouraged by looking at spring HFEs within power plant. Because where the damage or where the negative effect is bypass. If you're bypassing water, that's the negative effect. And so they estimate the way HFEs have been done, it's about $1.5 to $2 million effect or impact to hydropower with every HFE. That's primarily because bypass, you're not generating. So if we can start looking at some HFEs that could be done within power plant, you don't bypass, maybe you can do them more frequently.
Do you know why they can't do those high flow events through the turbines instead of using a bypass?
They can. But you know, it may be one of those, it's not enough. You aren't getting enough sediment up. And you aren't going enough or a long enough push up. You know, so when you bypass, you're getting a bigger flush.
Okay.
So, but what I'm been saying is, well, then why don't you look at one that doesn't kill hydro by bypassing, mm-hmm. do it within power plant.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can do them more frequently and not have the significant impacts, mm-hmm. the 2 million of that whack. Or maybe you can, you know, let's look at some designs where you can fluctuate more leading up to it. Because you're going to get an HFE to push that sediment up. We get some fluctuations leading up to it, so we get a little more flexibility. And then you do it within power plants so you don't bypass and lose the generation. So I'm encouraged with this new, what do they call it, the FLAG, Flow Ad Hoc Group. They're beginning to start a flow ad hoc group,
uh-huh.
to look at springtime HFEs and HFEs that could maybe be within power plant.
Adaptive management in action. Again.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's kind of like, you know, when I had my child way back in those days, and I was full-time working, my husband's full-time working, and someone said to me, you know, you can't do it all. You can't have it all. Well, but maybe it's good enough to have parts of. So I kind of look at HFEs like that. You know, do you have to do a 96 or 120 hour one every time you do it? Or can you be satisfied? The system is going to ebb and flow. So a hue and cry about all the sediment's going to be pushed out down to mean and we're going to lose all the beaches. That the monitoring since we started doing HFEs is not showing that. You know, you get a big benefit, then it erodes away. So maybe you do a littler one, then you erode. Then you do a more frequent littler one. But don't try to have it all. It's a balance, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, to be involved as long as you've been involved, you have to not only care about the resource that you're advocating for, but you have to really be committed to a collaborative process. And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about what you see as the central character of this collaborative process, how it's evolved over time. You must think it's been worthwhile to have been involved since 1999.
Yeah, I do, and you know, it may have its warts, and it gets picked at from time to time in publications. People write about it and say it's failed.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say back to them, what's the alternative?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at EIS processes, and you look at some of the big ones. Like the first EIS, Glen Canyon, was over $100 million.
Wow.
And so was that better than doing an EA or an EIS,
mm-hmm.
and still having the same type of public outreach? Did you get a better product, or did you get just a lot more model running? So I would say for collaboration, it's been, I think, not enough for some people. We heard from the tribes today from the Park Service, I guess, Jan, that no matter what projects the tribes would bring up, they would be pushed down in the whole budget thing. So they feel like, and I understand, I try to understand their perspective, but they feel like their voices aren't maybe heard enough. But what is an alternative? In probably about 2011, it was the same time that the desired future conditions process went forward. There was a comment made at an AMWIG meeting from a high-ranking interior person that said, why don't we just do away with this thing and let Reclamation operate the dam, let the Park Service manage the park resources, and let USGS do the science. We don't need any of this. Because I'm sure it's probably a pain for the administration that has to put up with these stakeholders that at times forget we're an advisory committee, sometimes feel like we could do a better job than they do. But what's the alternative? The law says you are going to consult with these entities. So I haven't yet heard a better option. At times I've heard we don't have enough academia in the room. You know, I don't know what stops. Do you remember Joe Feller?
Mm-hmm.
Joe Feller used to bring his ASU class right. now and again to some of these meetings. And Joe Feller and I used to go around and around about the
He was a law professor.
Yes,
right?
He was at ASU. And Joe Feller and I really had some very, very interesting debates about his interpretation versus mine of the Colorado River Storage Project Act. Uh-huh. We would never agree, but we knew that we just didn't ever agree. But Feller, rather than just standing back and saying, you guys don't have any academia, he would bring his class. So I would just say, hey, if somebody has a better idea, bring it.
A number of our interviewees have mentioned that without this program, there would be a lot more conflict and a lot more litigation.
No kidding. I'm glad you mentioned that because there have really been two cases. The Recovery Gold case wasn't on dam operations, so we have to set that aside. But that was a case that was filed by the Grand Canyon Trust about the recovery goals for the endangered fish. So it had effects. It had implications. And, of course, we felt like we had to intervene to get in there, you know. And that case was resolved. But the later trust case that came about, that had six claims maybe, and some of them would directly, if they were successful, were really... My take on that litigation was they wanted a certain type of operation and didn't get it administratively, so let's try the courts. And that's my take on it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, but looking at the process, because they also wanted additional NEPA for every annual operating plan. They wanted NEPA to have to be done for every mm-hmm. AOP. Uh-huh. And that would have drawn out the process. But yeah, that was... the tents for a little while, and all of us had to intervene. So, you know, we're spending all of our limited money, and we briefed. I'll send you that. We did a very short brief on hydropower mm-hmm. and the purpose, and I think it was quite, I would call that an accomplishment too, because to have a district court pick up that theme in our brief on the hydropower purpose, mm-hmm. I think was a pretty good accomplishment.
Yeah.
But yeah, without this, we would be probably like the Pacific Northwest is, with judges running the river. Now, I have my counterparts over there. It's just continual litigation and judges determining biops and all kinds of stuff. So is that what this program or these stakeholders would really like to see? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you, like virtually every other person we've interviewed.
And I haven't read any of the interviews that I'm sorry to say, but...
Everybody agrees that the program has been valuable and ought to be continued. It
sounds
like you're in the same boat.
Yeah.
Even people who are critical and disappointed say this is better than the alternative, that it's been good at building relationships and trust, that... We are improving decision-making based on science the way we hope in a rational program we would do. Nobody that we've interviewed has said,
good.
Let's throw it out.
That's pretty interesting, because you guys probably have some pretty diverse...
We try to get a lot of different voices. Well, that's kind of good to hear. Yes, it's one of our surprises.
Well, then I feel like that's an accomplishment that I put in 21 years into this, and all for not for naught, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So if it is continued in the future, where would you like to see it go? What kind of improvements in either the process or the outcomes would you like to see?
I'd like to see some more definition on metrics, because, you know, I think the program now has we have our universe of resources as big as it is, but it's still manageable. But I would like to see from the various stakeholders that are representing interests, what's your utopia for your resource? I can tell you what it is for hydropower. We're pretty easy. But the metrics, and I think reclamation is really trying to start at that. How do we get at the metrics? It was originally going to be called Phase 2 of the DFCs. That's what Ann Castle called
DFCs?
It. Desired Future Conditions.
Oh, yes.
And Phase 2 would have been the metrics.
And we never got to Phase 2. We'd never have a formal document.
She anticipated
metrics.
LTEMP would be it.
Uh-huh.
And it really wasn't.
So doing that would be a good step.
Yeah, and I think that's what they're starting, because we talked about it at AMWIG 1 year ago, and that was really kind of a need, because if you don't have a goal or a metric, well, a metric's really not a goal, is it? A metric is how you measure it.
Progress.
But if you don't have a finite, almost like a physical goal, then it'd be wonderful if we had unlimited dollars. We could do science on, you know, the color of this stuff. But it'll help us focus the science on where are the gaps. What do we not know yet? What do we know? I've heard the Park Service say many times in media, newspapers, we know enough. We know enough. We just need to operate the right way.
Hmm.
So there's been a lot of science in some areas, not so much in others. So what are the gaps, and do we need to do science on things if there isn't a logical connection to where we want to be? No.
So if I'm catching your meaning, are you suggesting that if we had metrics about the goals we're heading towards, we can not only measure whether we're making progress mm-hmm. or not, but we will also be able to determine whether some of the decisions we make about operations are achieving the desired
exactly.
effects if we know what it is that we're
exactly.
seeking out, if we can measure it.
And that's where it gets you back to the adaptive management.
Mm-hmm.
We can keep operating all day in a certain way, but is it good or not good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is good? How do you define good?
Right.
It really is a challenge, and for some resources are easier than others.
Right.
We have recovery goals for endangered fish, right? So we know we can do fish counts. What I don't know, and I would love recreation guys or mm-hmm. Park Service guys to tell me, what is your desire for camping beaches? Is it bigger beaches? Is it more frequent? More beaches? Mm-hmm. Is it quantity? Is it quality? Mm-hmm. What is it? I seriously am interested.
And that's never been quantified to your
no.
knowledge?
Uh-huh. No. And I would love to know that.
There are some things that would be difficult to quantify, like satisfaction on the part of a recreationist
exactly.
on a
exactly.
river trip in Grand Canyon.
Exactly, because when you do a survey, probably the majority of people that raft the canyon, it's their first time.
Mm.
They don't have anything to compare it to. And you know how survey questions are structured. How would anyone not say it was a wonderful experience?
Mm, right.
Unless they, if it's your second or third time, and this time the flows were way up, or the weather was bad. What are you going to do about that?
There's camel thorn everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Poked my foot.
Exactly. The last time I went on the Amway River trip was 20 years ago this year.
There wasn't that much camel thorn 20 years ago.
I don't even know what camel thorn is.
Yeah.
So,
I just went down the Grand Canyon in July for 18 days, and it was everywhere. I was shocked.
So where did that come? Is that a non-native
it's
species?
It's a non-native
invasive
species.
Okay, where did
species?
It come from?
Good question. I don't know. I just
know. Because, I mean, my touch point is tamarisk. You know, tamarisk was always like the big bad thing, but...
Right. Yeah, now it's providing shade, and
that's right.
It has more to offer than camel thorn.
And it provides housing for southwestern willow flycatcher, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like my comment today about life cycle impact assessment. You know, mm-hmm. every resource, or I guess you could look at all these river downstream resources, every resource has its good and its bad. It has pros and cons. And, you know, it wasn't all that long ago, because it was when Jack Schmidt was here. We started asking, what about vegetation? Don't just say that dam operations are doing in the beaches or are good or bad for the beaches. That's not the only thing that affects the experience. What about vegetation? And that's really when they kind of started looking at, now it's called an experiment, but... I call it a management action, vegetation removal.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the effects of campers on beaches? I don't know. Do they affect the sand on beaches? They got to. They've got to have some impact. So,
do you think we're looking at enough resources? Should we? Is our focus too narrow? Is it just right? Is it too broad? What do you think? And how has it changed over time?
I think for many years, and that was partly a function, my opinion, was because of the capability and the expertise of the folks who were running the center. And it was all sediment all the time. There was someone used to call it the all sediment channel. And there was, you look at the budgets, and the budgets were really heavily weighted to the physical resources. Then for a while, some voices came in saying, but wait a minute, what about the biology? We have this endangered chub, we got to do a lot more on that, because it's regulatory and and look what's transpired, bug flows.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, no one would have thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think we are adaptively managing and we're learning. I think in terms of a balance of resources, I'd like to see more on the biology. Because I think the stuff that Bill Pine and the Florida scientists did is fascinating. And
what was that focused on?
That was the steady flow experiment, the 5-year steady flow mm-hmm. experiment. Because it turned thinking on the head. People thought, chub are all using these backwaters, so we have to do HFEs in order to create backwaters. Well, they weren't. And it didn't take, you know, a $100 million experiment or a steady flow experiment that cost $30 million
mm-hmm.
to find that out. It was really just a lot of time spent in the field by people looking at the resources. So,
Fisheries people that we've talked to have also told us that there were some surprises there too, that at first they thought the trout were doing all this predation, and it turned out that maybe the brown trout, yes, but the main trout is rainbow trout, and they don't eat that many chub. And it took a long time for them to figure it out, but they, you know, they had a hypothesis. They did some research. They found out that they were a little bit wrong, and they revised their hypothesis.
Yeah, that's adaptively managing.
That's adaptive management. And it has led to changes in management and sort of, well, I suppose, can you talk a little bit about how you've seen... So what we're adaptively managing most of the time are dam operations, which always, as you've pointed out, always affects hydropower.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit more about how some of our learning over time in this program has been applied to dam operations in ways that you think are beneficial or not?
Well, I could comment on how I think it's been applied to more non-dam solutions,
mm-hmm.
because translocations,
Right.
Of fish into the tributaries. Looking at, let me think, temperature. Mm-hmm. Temperature is a hard one. Because several years ago we had a concept that we were really proposing a temperature control device. Right. And you know, that idea kind of went by the wayside, but that would have been a non-operation. It's operational, but it's not flow related.
Right.
Looking at vegetation management. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can do some things to help camping beaches where you don't have to just do a big old HFE.
Right.
So
is there resistance to coming up with solutions to some of these ecological problems that don't involve altering dam operations? Are there people saying our whole objective is to tell reclamation or interior how to alter dam operations?
I think there's a lot of that, because in a way it's the easy way. Uh-huh. It's the easy way. Uh-huh. It's, you can go turn switches and operate mm-hmm. the dam. But you know, I think if people look back at the Grand Canyon Protection Act, it is dam operations and other management actions. And so I would really like to see some of these other management actions, like the vegetation management. I'm really glad to hear that they actually got out there and started doing some of that. Mm-hmm. And whether it is called an experiment, because then it can be funded.
Would you explain that, please?
Do you want me to explain that?
Please.
When the concept of maybe doing manual vegetation removal and stuff came about, someone was crafty and said, if we call it an experiment, we can use power revenues to fund it through this program. If it's not an experiment, it's a management action, and another source of funding would have to be used.
Through appropriations or
Park Service funding.
Budget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's
so
why it's
a lot
called.
Of stuff is called experimental now. Well, that's adaptive.
It's adaptively naming things, right? So yeah, so I'm really waiting for this experiment to be written up and say, okay, you take what you learned from an experiment, then what do? How do you translate it into a management action?
Well, we're nearing the end of my list of questions. My next one is, what advice would you give to new people coming onto the adaptive management program? One of the things that we're producing in this project is a orientation packet for new members.
Okay.
And what do you think should go into that orientation packet? What kinds of information are really critical for somebody who's new? And what advice would you give to somebody if you were sitting here with somebody who's just coming on? What would you say to them?
Where do you start? Yeah. You know, this is really putting me on the spot, because I'm in the process of trying to write an orientation manual for my organization as we speak. So I've really been struggling.
Thinking about this.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot.
I'd love for you to share that with me
when I get it
completed.
When I get it done, yeah. I would maybe, you know, say, maybe from the Bible. I'm not a biblical person, but in the beginning, there was. So where did this program come from? Start with that. And because I think if people don't really understand where the program came from, why is it here? Mm-hmm. These are the laws or the documents that created it. This is why we're here. Mm-hmm. From that, you know, you can send them an important tool that I keep being reminded is that wiki. Because I always kind of forget to look, because I think we can find a lot of things there, but that's more of a tool than a... you know, we had... Over the next year, it may work itself out. If the small g guidance documents mm-hmm. are going to be re-looked at or refreshed... Because there was a lot of work put in over many years for the strategic science plan mm-hmm. what were some of these other, the research and monitoring plan. You know, there was a lot of thinking about a planning document. And we've kind of gotten away from that. And I think now, though, Reclamation is going to relook at some of those. Are they still relevant? Do they need to be changed to reflect LTEMP? But those were kind of the guidance and the framework from the program. Here's what we're doing. Here's a science plan. I think we seriously need a science plan that was supposed to come out of LTEMP. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have a good science plan implementing LTEMP. A science plan, so that doesn't help answer your question, because we don't have that to give to someone to say, right, here is our plan to implement LTEMP. A science plan, in my view, is the hypotheses. You know, here, again, your metrics or your goals and objectives. These are the hypotheses we're going to look at. These are the, this is how we're going to go about doing it. Here's what the science is going to look like. Here's, you know, a period of time. We don't have something like that to pick up. We have some experiments that were identified in LTEMP, but we don't have a comprehensive science plan for this program. So back to your question, I would, you know, if someone really needs to sit down and read a lot of stuff, and those fundamental, the strategic science plan, the monitoring and research plan, and then the triennial work plan and budget, because that's evolved over time, so that's really, really pretty good, because it talks about what each of the program elements are intended to do and what they're looking at, and here are the dollars associated. So that's a good, you know, that's a good beginning foundation.
Mm-hmm. What about ones, if you were going to provide advice to somebody joining the team, there are relationships, there's ways of behaving that are productive and not productive in a setting like this. What would you say about how somebody should approach their task as a representative of, as a stakeholder?
I could probably be accused of doing some of the things really the wrong way a lot of times in these meetings. But with age comes wisdom, right?
We hope.
Really trying to listen. You know, I'll look around the table, and I multitask as badly as everyone else around there, but try to really listen to what people are saying. And we've had a pretty big turnover lately.
Always or recently?
No, recently. Because I think for quite a while the same reps were there for a long time. And it's been a function of agency changes, but also just retirements, aging workforce. And when you only meet two times a year, then once on a webinar, it's very hard to develop the relationships. And, you know, I would say the relationships I have with most of these folks, in large part, is because I see them in other forums, not just here. So the state folks I see in other forums. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I know them better, you know. But the tribal folks starting with the river trip I went on in 1999. That's where I established my best relationships with.
That was the first river trip.
That was the first river trip.
Jan Balsam, I think, helped to organize that. Or no?
Mark Schaefer. Okay, that was the DOI person who took the vote on whether to leave it under reclamation or move it. Mark Schaefer was the lead on that river trip. And the purpose, really, of the river trip was to establish a vision and mission for this program.
Mary Orton was
from American Rivers.
Yeah, right. And she played a role in helping to. She was on the Vision and Mission boat, I think, when we did our interview with her.
That was
you
a
were
trip.
On that
yeah,
river
I was
trip,
on that
huh?
trip.
That was famous. We're going to write about that in our administrative history.
Now I had to come. I was only a half timer because I had to come up halfway at Phantom because I had other commitments. But that was a trip that. I really got to know Arden, Brenda Dry. Brenda Dry was with Wallapai Southern Paiute, and so she's not here anymore, but that's when Charlie mentioned Leslie and Brenda, or Leslie's in Brenda's flip charts. It was from that river trip. And so, and then from there, Don Goski, Mike Yates. So that's how I got to know them the best, and then I would continue to talk with them in trying to educate about why CRSP power is important to you guys. And so I, at twig meetings, I go to a twig meeting, invite them for lunch. And, you know, Zuni invited me to come out and talk to the Zuni leaders about hydropower and all that. And this has been a little while, but you have to really work hard at it. Because, again, with the changing personnel, I was thinking about that today, probably on that 1999 river trip, the only one that was on it that is still sitting around this table is Arden, maybe.
Arden who?
Kukate from Zuni.
From Zuni.
And I just found out he went on this river trip last month because he came in and, you know, we had a big hug and he said, why weren't you on the river trip? And I went, you were on there? I would have brought, we have a cardboard bat that we made a bat signal, and I still have that cardboard from a wine box.
But, so it's about building relationships, and it takes a lot of extra time, and it's hard work, but it pays off.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like I said, Kurt Dongoski, I never would have thought to hire him. Kurt used to work for Hopi when I first met him. And then that relationship terminated. So Creta, I hired him, I think, for maybe 6 years to advise us on all of this cultural stuff. So he did a great job for us. And he helped me develop that relationship with the tribes. And then he went to work for Zuni. So, and I think it's very hard to do it sitting in a meeting twice a year. You can't do it. You just can't. And I don't know what the solution is. Like David Brown said today, asking us to come for a 3-day meeting is a big time commitment. Yeah. And it really is. When you're sitting there trying to absorb all this, you're not building relationships.
Right.
And, you know, luckily back in those days, we didn't have social media either.
Right.
We had to pick up the phone and call each other. I'm aging myself here. But you know, the more... Now, here is something Ann Castle did. When Ann Castle first came on, she came to Phoenix, she went around and met with each AMWIG member separately. I'd never met her before. And I'd never seen that done. That would be a really good piece of advice for whoever the secretary's designee is. At least from a administration to stakeholder, but I still remember, I'd forgotten that. She came to my office and we sat down and talked about, you know, CRETA and the program, and because she was new and she had never met me. And
would that be a good strategy for any stakeholder to try to do something like that?
Yeah. You know, the other things that helped develop those relationships, now that desired future condition process, because if you didn't want to have an opinion, then you didn't participate. But if you wanted to help guide where that was going, you went and you beat your head against the wall and you argued with people, and we got done with a really important document. That was the first time I knew of in this program that there was a consensus document that in that kind of detail and magnitude that went up to the secretary.
And it occurs to me when you're talking about desired future conditions, you're really focused on values, which is a way to really get to know somebody and establish a relationship in a sense when you're not just talking about data.
Exactly. And that was really what structured decision making was trying to do, but I don't think it was the right tool for something this complicated. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a real good tool, like if you're going to go build a road and you have alternatives and you want to, or build a transmission line and you have different routes and you can kind of really define impacts. But it was a, I think I would be interested to know whether the USGS expert believed that that was a good use of that kind of a tool, because I think it was overwhelming.
Overwhelmingly beneficial?
No, overwhelmingly, it was too much. It was too much stuff.
All right, well, is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't cover, or any closing thoughts?
No, not that I can think of.
All right.
Not that I can think of.
Well, I'm very grateful.
You know, I'm never shy of words, right?
I'm very grateful that you took the time at the end of a long and difficult day. It was very generous of you to agree to do this.
Well, thank you. And I, again, I apologize for being, for playing hard to get.
Life is busy.
Yeah, it is.
All right.